Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
So there's economics, that fairly undefined discipline with differing opinions about what's right and what's wrong, pretty much driven by politics as much as it is by mathematics, with theories that bounce around wildly depending on who's offering them. Then there's real science, you know, physics, chemistry, biology, all the stuff we did at school, and in amongst all of that, thermodynamics, that bit of science that deals with heat and energy. Pretty fundamental, right? And surely energy is at the heart of economics. So how did so many economists miss it out? And that waste that consuming energy creates. So what can we learn from thermodynamics? And what part should it play in economics? That's today on the Debunking Economics podcast with Professor Steve Keen. I'm Phil Dobby. Welcome along. So, Steve, the idea that economics should embrace thermodynamics has been around for a while, hasn't it? So there was a Romanian economist, I'm sure you're familiar with him, Nicholas Georgescu Rogan, who wrote The Entropy Law and the Economic Process in 1971. It was about the same time that we saw the Club of Rome releasing Limits to Growth, wasn't it? So it's been the first point in all of this, when you say that we need, you know, there needs to be more of an acceptance of it. We've been saying that for decades now.
And economics has gone backwards on that front at the same time, which is quite appalling. That's one reason why I got into working on ecological economics to begin with, because how pathetic economics has been on this whole front. It has continued to ignore the laws of thermodynamics. And therefore, you get nonsense like economists believing you can produce output using labor and capital alone. Totally a disembodied view of how production occurs in the economy, which is one reason they can't understand climate change. And when they come at it, they think they're being wisdom, and it's pathetic.
So let's take a step back then. What are the laws of thermodynamics? And then let's look at how they can be applied.
Well, I've got to say, first of all, I am a...
An economist.
unfortunately. I'm an amateur on thermodynamics. Yeah. I've got to say that right from the outset. And thermodynamics is also one of those things that I've forgotten who said this about quantum mechanics, but if somebody said, if you think I understand quantum mechanics, that shows that you don't. Okay? So it's one of those very, very hairy areas. But the basic idea is, first of all, the amount of energy in the universe is a given. The first law of thermodynamics is energy can neither be created nor destroyed. So there's a set amount of energy, and that's it. And this is one of these, again, things which has come out of largely out of observation to a large degree. The laws were worked out in an observational sense to begin with in the 19th century. But one of the first things people realized was you cannot make energy. And the classic statement of this is there's no such thing as a perpetual motion machine. So you can't have something which takes X amount of energy in and gives 2X amounts of energy out. Does not happen. You can take energy in, you can use it to do work, and that will then transform the energy, but it will not change the absolute quantity. So that's what's called the zeroth law. There's no... the amount of energy that exists is what you've got to use. You can't create it. That's the fixed amount.
At any point in time, though, because, I mean, there's energy storage, isn't there? So when I burn oil to fuel my car, then I'm getting energy to make my car move. I guess there was energy created to produce that oil, but...
Well, if you think about your car and burning the oil, you've got potential energy inside the oil. It becomes, to actually make your car work, you're converting that chemical potential energy into actual kinetic energy. But to do that, you are also, if you think about an engine as a heat engine, and this is where a lot of the insights in thermodynamics came from, what if the what if the motive force that's causing you to go forward is simply heat flowing from one point to another? So you have a hot reservoir and a cold reservoir, and between the two you have a wheel. And if you connect the two reservoirs through the wheel, then the heat will flow from the hot to the cold, and as it does so, it will cause the wheel to spin, and the wheel to spin makes your car go forward. Now, that's the fundamental frame. It's called a Carnot. I don't know how to pronounce it, so it's French. I'm bound to be pronouncing it badly. But the Carnot heat engine was one of the original concepts in working out the laws of thermodynamics. And an essential part of that is you can't do work using energy without creating waste. And that's the curliest of the laws. That's the second law of thermodynamics, that there's, if you're going to...
Which is what the word entropy, which is...
That's the word entropy, yeah. And look, it's a whole lot of...
Basically means to disorder or waste.
Disorderize. Yeah. So if a system is... the example I used to use in lectures quite regularly, and it seems to get through, is imagine that you... take all the air inside a lecture theatre and you squeeze it into 1 cubic centimetre of space. So you've got 10,000 cubic metres of lecture space, and you've got it all the air is squared into 1 cubic centimetre. Now, if you want to compare that to... then you open up the cubic centimetre and all the air rushes out into the room, which of those two states has more order?
I'd say when it was all... condensed, because it's got to be in order to
fit it
in.
Is so
that and then when you go out, you just go all over the place when you release it.
That's right. So that's the basic idea, the idea of the number of states in which it's feasible that all the molecules of air in the room spontaneously end up in 1 cubic centimeter is outrageously low likelihood of happening. And that's what's called a situation, and I always get this wrong. I've got to check it each time I bloody well do it. Low entropy, okay? Right. You have a very low... hang on, I better check that.
So low entropy means there's a great deal of order.
A great deal of order. High entropy means disorder.
Yeah.
Okay? So, and what that means, if you think about it, let's say it's a billion, billion, billion molecules, and that's probably an underestimate of the number oxygen... molecules in a lecture theatre, then there's, if you distribute it randomly throughout the lecture theatre, if you swap one oxygen molecule from one side of the lecture theatre to the other, you make absolutely no difference in the equilibrium situation for the entire room. So there's many, 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 many ways of organising those molecules and still having the same overall distribution of molecules in the room itself. That's high disorder. That's high entropy. Now, when you have a highly organised state, it's low entropy. Now, you think about what is, and that's the overall framework. And we're talking about, objects that don't have any sense of purpose to them, oxygen molecules in a room. What about when you then try to apply that to production? What's going on in production? Well, production appears to go in the opposite direction, and that is we're taking in a whole range of things which, even though like iron ore is more organized than just soil, iron ore is less organized than steel. So you're taking high entropy, disorganized, disordered stuff, putting it through an energy processing, like a bit of blast furnace, you've got to have heat coming in to do that, and you turn it into slag on the one hand and iron on the other, and you've actually, what we look at, we throw the slag away and forget about it, and we focus upon the iron alone, and the iron is more ordered than the iron ore was beforehand, and all the other elements to make it.
Right.
So...
So going from low entropy to high entropy, if I've got that right, going from a disorganized state to a more organized state, we still end up with the same amount of energy, but it's in a more concentrated way.
We've got waste, and this is the point that you can't produce anything without waste.
Mm.
Okay. So, and there's there's actually a lovely summary of these laws by the old poet Allen Ginsberg. And when I first sort of thought, that's brilliant, who first wrote it, and turns out it was Allen Ginsberg, he says the laws of thermodynamics are the following. First law, the zeroth law, is you can't win. Okay, you're in a game. Law zero, you can't win. Law, the second law, the second law is that you can't break even. Okay, so you're going to lose. And the final law is you can't leave the game. So what is that all? So the first thing, no energy is created. There's no net gain that come out of it. That's the zeroth law, that the amount of energy is a constant. The first law, I'm going to jump over that to some extent. It's basically talking about uniformity, it's the absence of capacity to create and uniformity in the system under thermodynamic equilibrium. But the second law is you can't break even. It means that if you're going to do work, you're going to necessarily waste some of the energy you use. Mm-hmm. And the basic idea there is that, taking back to the heat engine idea, if you have a hot reservoir and a cold reservoir, and you join the two together, then the first law of thermodynamics is going to mean that the hot reservoir, which is going to have molecules moving very quickly, will, just by the random bouncing of molecules off each other, will move towards the cold, and you'll get a uniform temperature between the hot and the cold, unless you continue adding more heat to the hot reservoir. Now that motion will then go through the wheel, and that will turn the wheel and let you to do enable you to do work. So if you imagine the wheel is first of all a blocking the two, you've got the brake on, and it won't let the hot air flow to the cold reservoir. Then you take the brake off, and that lets the wheel spin. That's doing work. But then the work stops when the temperature of the hot and cold reservoirs becomes the same. Now, the only way to do that at 100% efficiency, convert all the heat energy into work, is to be able to dump that waste energy in a location which is at zero degrees. And I don't mean, I don't actually know which is at zero. I should be saying 0 degrees. Mm. Zero, absolute as in zero.
Yeah.
Absolute zero Kelvin, zero Kelvin. And the third law of thermodynamics is there is no place at absolute zero.
Mm.
So there is no place that you can do that.
So if you started and you didn't delve down as far as we've done, in the first 10 minutes of this discussion, and you started with, if you just read thermodynamics and the first thing you read is that basically there's an unlimited supply of energy, then you'd go...
You can't destroy it.
Whatever it is, you can't destroy it. So there's more than enough of it. You go, well, that's great for economics then, isn't it? We don't need to worry too much about it because it's always going to be there. And if we have some waste, we can live with a bit of waste because there's so much of the stuff. So why do we need to worry?
Boy, I wasn't expecting that twist. let's bring in another cheery little subject called the heat death of the universe.
I'm filling in my membership form for the Tory Party while I'm saying this. Now I'm just being the devil's advocate, obviously. But I mean, you can
apply for the Nobel Prize on economics. At the same
I could
time.
As well. Yeah, exactly. You could understand why people would be saying that. They'll go, oh, there's loads of energy, a bit of waste. Who's too concerned about that if there's so much energy around?
Yeah, well, the trouble is that over time, the second law applies at a universal rule, and energy, in one sense, goes from high frequency to low frequency over time, and that is just going to continue happening, and ultimately the argument is the universe will become empty because the energy will be distributed with such low-grade energy over such large region that it'll be effectively, localized areas will have zero energy. So it's not an argument for that. What it is an argument about, and this is why I think it's absolutely essential, is first of all, you can't do anything without using energy.
Mm-hmm.
Energy is absolutely essential. The very first thing you have to think about in production is the role of energy. And the second thing is that if you're going to use the energy to perform work, you will necessarily generate waste. Now, if those ideas had been part of economics, we might not be facing an environmental catastrophe in the next one or two decades.
Now, but some people would say that it is, because it's factored in terms of price. So, our use of resources is priced in. So oil is more expensive when there's less of it. If we pass the point where there's, of peak oil, then presumably it's going to get progressively more expensive. So that would mean we would look at alternatives. And hey, presto, the environment is miraculously protected. I mean, that would be the theory.
Like to, I've got something to sell you, which obviously you're going to be stupid enough to buy of me. Would you like to buy some? Would you like to buy some slag?
That is the question. What do you do with the slag? I grew up in the north of England. You just you plant grass on it and have these nice mounds all over the.
Oh, okay.
And then kids can slide down it come winter. That's where you do your snow. Stand the slag heaps. It's a positive, Steve. Get rid of this negative attitude. We like slag in the north.
Please pass the scotch. I need some after that one. In terms of trying to bring this into mathematical modeling, the way that I got into this is, I was aware of Jessica Rogan's work. I've read some of it, not all of it, I must confess. And of course, I've read Limits to Growth cover to cover numerous times, but I was aware of the need to incorporate energy properly into economic theory. And that hadn't been done because economics had. Economics, as I did back at university and school in the late 60s, early 70s, you were taught there were four factors of production: land, labor, capital, and enterprise.
Yeah.
Those were the so-called... Okay. Well, over time, land dropped out of the equation, enterprise disappeared, and your factors of production were labor and capital. That was it. Okay, and the neoclassicals use what's called a Cobb-Douglas production function, and that literally describes production as being a function of a disembodied thing they call technology, labor raised to a power, which the power is based on the share of labor in GDP, which is about 0.7, and then capital raised to 1 minus that power. And the reason for the powers is that if you double all labor and double all capital, you get double output out of it. It's what they call constant returns to scale. But that's the way economists think about production now, in terms of a Cobb-Douglas production function. Some of them use a fancier thing called a CES production function, but I think that's it's bullshit that they use it, so I won't bother talking about it. But that's their model, and that means you can produce output using labor and capital. No need for materials, no need for energy. Now, that's garbage. Okay, that is just simply garbage. And I saw various attempts to try to bring it into economic modeling, particularly by a good friend of mine, Bob Ayers, who did most of the work on the role of energy in production. But the way it was brought in was, say, we've got labor as a factor of production and capital as a factor of production. We need to bring energy as a factor of production as well. And that didn't sit well with me either, because it's easy to imagine tell a worker, okay, that's your machine, go and work on that machine. The machine's already there. And those are two, the worker can walk in, the machine's been placed inside the factory. How do you put the energy in? Okay. Do you just throw energy at the machine and the labourer, chuck a hand grenade inside and see what happens? Of course you can't. The energy has to be managed by the worker and by the machine. So this is one of my favourite little cliches. That's my contribution to economics. Labour without capital, labour without energy is a corpse, and capital without energy is a sculpture. In other words, energy is needed as inputs to both labour and capital to enable them to do work. But to do that work, because the energy, not all of it is converted into work. You only get 100% conversion. In fact, you get less than 50% in a generic sense can be converted into actually work at the aggregate level. To generate that production, you must generate waste. And then what you've got is a fundamental integration of energy economics and ecology, because that waste has to be dumped back into the environment. And that's my way of bringing the insights of thermodynamics into economics. It isn't that we have to use the mathematics of thermodynamics, which is extremely complicated. Statistical mechanics, it's called. It's an entire field of physics. But you have to acknowledge that you can't produce anything without energy, and to produce anything, you must necessarily generate waste. And that, to me, is the fundamentals of bringing thermodynamic which is not, insights. Yeah,
which we do not factor in at all. So
no, not at all.
So, and a great example is how we knock buildings down. There was someone talking about this on the radio the other day, and I think this might have been what Schumpeter was talking about when he was talking about creative destruction, the idea that we will destroy wealth to create new wealth. So, for example, we'll knock down a building which is perfectly good at performing a particular function, but we'll knock it down to build something which we think will be better, and we won't worry about the waste that's been created, even though I think about half of all landfill in the UK, and I'm sure it's the same around the world, is building waste, because we don't care about the cost of building wealth. So we will destroy that inherent wealth in whatever the function of that building was, because we want to create something which is going to be more efficient, and we don't have to account for that waste in any model.
Yeah, that wasn't really Schumpeter's point, argument. But nonetheless, yeah, but nonetheless, it is the central. It isn't just even demolishing anything, it's actually producing something in the first place. That's why I use slag as an example, because when I tried to mathematically model this, it was very easy to model, to go from a model without energy at all to one where energy was fundamentally really the only input, because you had labor taking in energy to be able to do to operate the machines taking in energy so that the gears actually turn and process stuff, and the what I got was effectively a model with pure energy as the inputs and pure energy as the output, you know, non-usable energy at one end, usable energy at the other. And then that was the simplest model. But then when myself and Matteo Scorselli and Tim Garrett got together and tried to include matter in the modeling as well, we got a real difficulty in trying to do it intellectually, because it's very, we're working in the idea of a single commodity, and this is again is a hang up in economics. Economic models, the Cobb-Douglas production function, which is dominates neoclassicals, even the Leontief, which dominates post-Keynesians, are both working in the abstraction of a single commodity. So you have a single commodity which you can either use to consume or to invest. And this is what was originally called the corn economy model, which Ricardo had. So you can imagine having corn as a consumer item. You can eat corn. It's also an investment item. You can plant the corn and then it will grow with you know, sunlight and rain, which you're ignoring, and soil, which you're ignoring. The one piece of corn will turn into 1,000 pieces of corn, and you've got production as well. But when we tried to generalize it and say, well, let's imagine a world in which you need both energy and matter as your inputs, the inspiration we had was the work by John Hicks back in 1935, I think it was, to attempt to build a model involving both involved labor, capital, and input, a material input, which was, in his case, he had wheat, and wheat being turned into bread. But he couldn't manage to, with the model of wheat as the commodity, how do you imagine building a factory out of wheat? Okay. Mm. And we got sort of, you know, I got the same, how the hell do I do this? And then I finally got the inspiration of saying, well, the idea that you can use wheat as a consumer good, that's fine. You know, you can imagine planting wheat, you can imagine eating wheat, that's easy. But wheat as a machine, how do you do that? And then I thought, well, let's go to the other extreme. Let's imagine a totally crazy consumption good, which makes the production side of things easy to model. And have you ever seen a cartoon called the Iron Giant?
No.
Okay, it's a bit of a cult cartoon from the late 90s, early zeros, I think, about a kid who finds a very philosophical giant made of iron who's crashed on the planet, blah, blah, blah. Long story. It's worth having a look at. So I imagine there's a planet of the iron giants where the consumers are iron giants who survive by eating iron. Okay. And you have a iron ore mine, you have a coal mine, and you have a factory that combines the coal and the iron to produce coal and the iron ore to produce iron plus slag, which I know you guys in the north of England go sliding on, but you know, it's a waste product. And then the consumers could consume the iron. The iron could be used to make the machines that mine the coal, mine the energy, and and create the factory as well. And that worked as a way of modelling it. But the essential thing was you're producing waste matter. And in this case, it's slag that you're producing, which cannot be used for any other purpose. So what you then get is that can degrade your environment over time. Now, that's exactly what we're doing to the planet on a global scale.
Through industrialization, aren't we? So when we, if you had sort of like a stable population and we were all living off the land with crops that would just replenish themselves each year, and if that was enough to keep us going, then we wouldn't be damaging. We would be, you know, we would like be in a stationary state. You know, the economy would be functioning and we'd be living at one with the planet. We wouldn't be degrading itself. That's a hard word, isn't it? It's industrialization which is creating this problem, isn't it?
Exactly. And exactly. Mm. Industrialization has been powered by energy, and the energy has been fossil fuels.
Yeah.
And the predominant waste we're talking about is fossil fuel waste, but it's by no means the only one. We're reducing waste matter as well. On a grand scale, not just the the carbon dioxide, but a whole range of other waste products as well. So if you start from a position which respects the laws of thermodynamics, you have to integrate economics with the ecology. You have to accept that waste is generated, and that gives you a perspective of a physical and realistic biophysical view of how the economy operates, which would throw neoclassical economics out the bloody window, which is where it belongs.
Yeah.
So,
but as you said, it's complicated, isn't it? And that means that's which is why you've gone down the road that you've gone on, which is to look at complex systems and the systems dynamics approach. Through your Minsky model, which is obviously a hell of a lot more complicated than just basic economic theory, but it could get much more complicated because you're saying there's the whole discipline of thermodynamics is hellishly complicated. Does economics need to go down that same road even further?
This is what Georgeshko Rogan largely acted as if you needed to bring in the maths of thermodynamics to handle production, and like to have the concept of statistical mechanics taking over how we think about economics. And my feeling, I'm not enough of an expert on his work to be didactic about this, but I think that was one bridge too far. What you need is an awareness of thermodynamics as a limit, as a fundamental limit that determines how you model what you can actually do in a physical society. That's vital. But then, do you need to use that same mathematics to model production? Probably not. And that's why I've been building models that include energy and include matter, and simply have the awareness that you have to have waste energy and you have to have waste matter as part of the mathematics. And then you feed that into your overall, you build a model showing you have physical constraints, the amount of waste that can be absorbed by your ecosystem per unit of time, the stores of energy that you have that can be used as well. All those parts of the framework, they're sufficient to have those without actually doing the whole thing using the mathematics of statistical mechanics.
Right. So if we're boiling it down, it's not a complex, and it's an easily understandable notion, isn't it, that in the industrial society that we live in today, we create waste and we're not accounting for it in the way we operate as we do in part in that, if you dump water into a river as a factory, maybe you're going to get charged for that or get fined for it, but we're not accounting for it in its full sense. But are we anywhere close to, if we were trying to put numbers on this, to include it in a model so that we had a more stable economy? Has anyone got any idea? How do you put numbers behind pollution?
Yeah, well, that's what Larger with the Limits to Growth was attempting to do back in the 70s, 60s and 70s. And they did a damn good job of it. I've seen so many criticisms of the Limits to Growth, and they're almost all ill-informed. I saw another one today on Twitter that I had a bit of a jump on. The sophistication behind that, it was a case of parsimonious simplification. So rather than having like the multitude of inputs that are needed to produce the multitude of outputs that we consume in a modern society, they had a numerical factor indicating resources, another numerical factor indicating consumption. And they then did a large amount of work that wasn't written up in the book itself of generating an index number for each of the, I think it was seven major factors that turned up in the, pollution was one, population was another, production, consumption a third, et cetera, et cetera. And they then producing index numbers for each of these, they made the model fit data from 1900 to 1970, and then they ran it forward. So the empirical fitting was making it fit the index numbers they generated out of those aggregate indicators from 1900 to 1970. And, you know, it was derided by, of all people, guess who? William Bloody Nordhaus, as being data measurement without data. In fact, that was just a tactical mistake by the Limits to Growth group. They published the popular report without the data appendix, and they published the actual detailed thing 2 years after. And in the meantime, their reputation had been trashed by Nordhaus and other neoclassical economists. But they'd done the right thing. They'd done a damn good job of modelling the interdependency between the economy and the ecology, and the fact that if you push the economy too far, the ecology won't be able to cope and you'll have a breakdown.
Mm. That's where you reach tipping points, which adds another element of complexity to all of this, doesn't it? I mean, you say that, you know, you don't need to go down the complexity of thermodynamics, but if you're starting to look at, you know, the interactions within the environment, I mean, that is hellishly complicated. And I wonder if we fully understand when we dump a certain type of pollution, what the flow-on effects from that are. And we might have it, we might put a figure on it today, but it might contribute to a tipping point, which would mean we actually should have put a bigger value on it because it's speeded up another process.
But if we had an economics that began from those foundations, we'd have respect for those problems to begin with. We would not have the gung-ho attitude of neoclassical economics, which I saw exemplified in a new post by John Crane, a guy who calls himself the grumpy economist, throwing in his late contribution to the economics of climate change. And it was just, if I wrote a parody, I'd write of how blasé economists are about the impact of the economy on the ecology. I'd write what he wrote. Now, I've got to give him some credit. I decided to hold back and what I actually was feeling and just wrote, here are six references you should read. And he's published that comment on his blog. Whether he reads them or not, I'll have to wait and see. But one important part of those was tipping points. And we are now, with the level of understanding we have now of the complexity of the planet's ecosphere, we're becoming more and more aware of just how fragile and how tenuous the current climate is. And the tipping point that I'm focusing most on right now is Arctic summer sea ice, because the fact that the planet has the temperature it has is partially due to the fact that the North and South Poles reflect, when they were all ice-laden, reflect a large amount of the radiation the sun projects onto it back into outer space. So perfect mirrors, or not perfect, but damn good mirrors. When you replace them with open water, which is what's happening with the Arctic, the impact is you go from a reflector of energy to an absorber of energy. And in the case of the Arctic, this is one thing, again, the factoids I've learned by reading a lot of science literature, the amount of energy that falls on the Arctic Circle during summer is greater than the amount of energy that falls on the tropics. And the reason being, of course, the Arctic, during summer, the Arctic Circle is in sun 24 hours a day. The tropics are in sun for 12. And even though there's more energy per square meter falling on the tropics, it's not more than double what falls on the Arctic. So if we go from reflecting that energy to absorbing it, there's an enormous increase in the effective energy retention from the sun. And the calculations I've seen in some papers say that it's equivalent to roughly 25 years of the output of carbon dioxide we're doing right now. So if we...
None of this is a concern to me, though. Yeah, I mean, I'm running my coal mine in the north of England, and everyone loves me because I'm contributing these slag heaps.
Nice slag heaps for the kids to ride down.
They love me too. And I'm employing people locally. And so long as I don't have to pay anything other than wages and, you know, my cost of production, I'm happy, and so is everybody else. So, I mean, how do you attribute those climate damages to businesses? And there's always different forecasts as well, aren't there? So for everyone picking a bad forecast, you can always get people saying, but, you know, here's another forecast which says it's not as bad. So there's an element of risk modelling that has to come into all of this, isn't there? And we never see that. We if you want to go down the easy road, then you follow Nordhaus and you go, it's not going to be that bad. Here's my model. It's not really going to impact the environment, as, you know, GDP is only going to fall marginally. because I'm going to ignore the worst forecast. Whereas if you took his and said, well, okay, there's a 20% chance that's going to happen. Let's take the other 80% into your model, and you know, and that says it's going to be a worse scenario. But we don't do that.
No, we don't. And like again, we treat the planet like we treat a you know, tossing a dice. You know, they got a 50-50 chance of getting heads. If you spin it often enough, you're going to get 500 heads and 500 tails, roughly, if you toss it 20,000 times. The trouble is we don't have 1,000 planets. If we get this wrong, there's only one planet, and it's too late to reverse the damages. And that is the situation I think we've got ourselves into. And largely, having an economics which is ignorant of the laws of thermodynamics, I think is a large part of why we've ended up so blind as we become so close to tripping those tipping points.
So how do we implement it then, very quickly, using the system, you know, because we can't move too far from the system we have now because we're sort of wedded to it globally, but how do we make a significant change to it that does embrace this idea of thermodynamics and waste? How do we implement it in a meaningful way that we can just, you know, slide it in to the way we operate currently?
We don't.
I knew you were going
it's
to say
too
that.
Late. It's
too late. Here we go again. It's not too it's late, too, Steve. It's, there's got to be, well, there's too, be
it's too late to
do.
Slide, okay? Right. This is not a slide anymore. This is slam the fucking brakes on and hit reverse. Yeah. Throw the anchor out the back over, okay? But it's that sort of thing.
Right, but you know that's not going to happen because we see, you know,
that's protests. My trouble. We're not going to do it until after we find we're crashing. Okay, that's my pessimistic expectation. Okay.
So we are a more open society, and we realise that we're all doomed. What should we do then? What should change? How do we in the quickest possible way?
Drastic reduction of consumption levels, and another recent.
But we're still creating waste. I mean, that was going to be one of my questions.
We're still creating waste, but if the average American energy consumption goes down by a factor of 10. And that's energy consumption in general, not just coal and oil, but 90% fall in the average energy consumption of an American.
Yeah.
That's the sort of scale that's necessary to mean we don't.
So these are the numbers that Extinction Rebellion have been pushing out, and everyone's going, yeah. Well, that would mean a catastrophic end to if you cut the amount of energy that's consumed in America, you destroy the economy, and
that would create a lot
of hunger and poverty as
well. The burden has to fall on the rich for the obvious reason: it falls on the poor, they're going to die, and too many of them have got guns in America to run that chance. It's something which I think there has to be. We're not going to do it until it becomes bleedingly obvious. So, you know, the fact we had these incredible heat waves in Canada. I mean, Canada almost holds the world record for temperatures now on the globe. It's about 1 degree short of Death Valley. Canada, yeah. You know, who would have picked that? And at the same time, the floods that are occurring on the other side of the country. This has all been potentially driven, I can't say because I'm not a scientist, but potentially driven by the breakdown of the Arctic summer sea ice and the impact, and this is something that Hansen does talk about, the impact of the dramatic melting of the Greenland and the Antarctic, meaning there's too much fresh water in both those extremes of the conveyor belt systems that keep the ocean circulation flowing, and it may well be they're going to break down and cause superstorms. So all this stuff is, and when they start hitting, those superstorms could, you know, if you're going from hail, you know, massive hail one day to absolute heat the other, your agriculture is going to fail. And I think it's going to be when that sort of thing starts happening in Europe and America in particular, then we might find realizing, hell, we've got to hit the brakes. And how hard? You know, hard enough to cause G-forces in the slowdown.
But can't we, in the meantime, just introduce an entropy tax? You know, if you are contributing to the destruction of the efficient use of energy and creating waste as part of that process, you should be taxed heavily for that, because then that would encourage us to work in a way which is going to at least alleviate some of the problems.
Well, that's actually how they managed to fight the Second World War. They put a large tax on bullets.
It would have worked, though, wouldn't it? Imagine if both sides had done that.
We could have taxed the Nazis out of existence. you know, this is the trouble. We've left it too late. And the economics has an incredible responsibility for leaving in this situation. You may have seen that video of a couple of lobbyists in Washington being scammed by investigative reporters to reveal that they were supporting the idea of carbon taxes because they knew they'd never happen. So they could actually go and make, yes, we report a carbon tax, blah, 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 and look like they were doing all these good things for the environment as a way of avoiding any reduction on the activities of fossil fuel manufacturers. So, it is just too late. It is just too late. And we won't be doing it in any market mechanism way or even any tax way. It's going to have to be a drastic realization. Holy hell, we've destabilized the Holocene temperatures that made it possible to develop civilization in the first place. Unless we recreate those situations, we're not going to have a civilization anymore. And to do that, recreate those situations, we'll have a drastic reduction in our energy consumption and reduction in waste.
I'm sure Nordhaus would say, though, if he was listening to this, I'm sure he never listens to you, but if he was listening to this, he'd be saying, well, I am taking account of thermodynamics. That's what I do. I am dealing with the fact that we are having an impact on the environment. It's just that his numbers are less than you might like.
His numbers are a fantasy, and so is his model, which I'm looking at right now.
Right. Let's not get into that. We're going to run out of time now. But I mean, but we could say, well, we need to embrace this into economics. And I'm sure he would say, I already have. It's just a question.
Yeah, he'd be wrong. He's wrong about the damage as well.
But it is a question about what numbers do you put in, because it's a complex system. So aren't we also saying we just need to, modeling needs to be a lot more complex because we need to get more accurate numbers out of all of this?
Well, you need a modelling framework that actually acknowledges the interaction of the economy with the ecology and the fact that the ecology is number one and the economy is number two. And there's no way I could accuse Nordhaus of that.
All right. Very good. One time we'll have to I'll just ask you the question, what's wrong with Nordhaus? Get the recorder going, and I'll just go out for the day and turn it off when I get back. Anyway, till then, good to talk, Steve. Have a great day.
Okay, mate.
While we still can. And I'll catch you soon, if you're here next week, if any of us are still alive. We'll see you then.
Indeed.
Cheers.
Okay, bye.
Goodbye. I think the problem is it's actually not being treated as an emergency because of politics. I mean, even things which are fairly obvious, like vaccines can help you stop dying from COVID, you still get a vocal minority who struggle with the bleeding obvious and say, well, we're not going to take vaccines. It's an infringement of our freedom to die. So if we need to cut emissions by almost 8% per year every year from now to 2030, that is a number that's being bandied about, to prevent warming getting beyond 1.5 degrees, that's never going to happen. Because 10 years ago, we only needed to cut it back 3.3% each year, but we didn't, hence the higher target now. So in 5 years, it's going to be higher still, and we're just never going to do it. So the problem is the deniers, and equally those who underplay it, like Nordhaus, but also maybe Steve Keane too, the doomsayers who say it's too late to do anything, we might as well just go and have lunch, because that approach can be used as an approach by those who don't want to even bother trying. Sorry about that, Steve, but I think that could be the upshot if we all followed that approach. Anyway, we'll catch you next week for another edition of the Debunking Economics podcast with Professor Steve Keane. I'm Phil Dobby. I'll see you then.
When it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com. The number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.
If you've enjoyed listening to Debunking Economics, even if you haven't, you might also enjoy The Y Curve. Each week, Roger Hearing and I talk to a guest about a topic that is very much in the news that week. It's lively, it's fun, it's informative. What more could you want? So search The Y Curve in your favorite podcast app or go to ycurve.com to listen.